Now this is Channel 2 Right. This is Channel 2 Right. And a continuation of the class discussion on Monday, the 21st of April, 1969, of the Divinity School Address. This is Channel 2 Right. In the middle of the discussion on Monday, the 21st of April, 1969, that's the Monday of the fourth week, the Divinity School Address. This is Channel 2 Right, Channel 2 Right, Channel 2 Right, the beginning of Channel 2 Right. And the continuation of the discussion in class on Monday, the 21st of April, 1969, of the Divinity School Address. Sculpture and architecture. The seer also wants to build and paint. And as I remember, he says, but words are the most satisfying. Well, now he thinks so, and Emily Dickinson thinks so. Catch the glimpse, and then you have to follow it. But if society is there, you don't follow it. If society is there, or the institution there, society, isn't it? Society is a group of institutions. Well, we're all institutionalized. Have the glimpse, or if we did have it, we wouldn't pursue it. And the church is there, historical Christianity. We won't have it, or if we did have it, we wouldn't pursue it. That's just a parallel. Looks like we're trying to rewrite it for him, doesn't it? Oops. Now he's, you see, I think in, if you carry several, the other over into religion, I think it's, him. You see, the institution is so important. So important. And I'm not sure that he can make Christ, Jesus a scholar or the individual genius. And I think he has to. I think he has to, actually. But now you see, he's got that term. I forget now just where it is. Where he says on instruction that let me see if I can find it. You see, I wouldn't undertake to go into the you know, the terminology, the conventional terminology of the Holy Spirit. You see, I'd just be ridiculous, and that may be one reason why Emerson is restrained in this. That shows the direction, you see. He says it, really. One stirring condition, it's an intuition. That is, moral sentiment is an intuition. It's a light. It's something that comes to a person. It's not instruction, but provocation. Truly speaking, it is not instruction, but provocation that I can receive from another soul. That's not as strong as you can make it. Two men speak of revelation as something that's historical. Happened long ago. I think the best statement of that is the beginning of his little essay, Nature. I think that's just remarkable, that first opening of the essay, Nature. Just remarkable. We don't have revelations ourselves. We're just the historians of other people's revelations. As far as I'm concerned, there is no sentiment of virtue. There is no moral sentiment. There is no religious sentiment anymore. As far as I'm concerned, it doesn't exist. And it exists for me. I think it once did. I think there once were books on it. And you know about this? That's it. That's it. That's it exactly. But now, you see, I have a feeling that what Emerson wants to say, and you see, they excommunicated him for saying what he did. He wasn't invited back for a generation. Was what I have a feeling is he wanted to say was, you see, that the Holy Spirit can be with the minister and make him say things that vitalizes people that hear him. But what I think he sort of wants to say all along is that any spirit is holy. And there's no use formalizing one that appears to you at one place and calling that holy when any spirit is. Spirit. supreme wisdom and infinite law, or something, or vice versa. Absolutes are too much for me. I read Yeats, and I'm sorry I did. But I can't use absolutes anymore. I'm saying that that's what he wants to say, but I'm saying that's what I have a feeling that he was on the point of saying. But he said too much as it was. Yes, yes, yes. And Jesus is a mediator. Has to be fairly reserved, doesn't he? He can't tear down the whole structure, fabric of religion, and substitute, make it an English class up at the university. That'd be awful, wouldn't it? Suppose they carried on church the way we do here. Wouldn't that be awful? Just awful. A picture of the hereafter, and I can just lacerate myself by picturing myself up there with certain people I know. I'm telling you, I'd rather not go to the hereafter if I had to have that company. Milton thought of it as those little independent. I forget the phrase. And listen to this. He sings of those little independent societies singing hymns. That's that Presbyterian ideal that was just marvelous, you see. And you know that that's what he wants to do, here and hereafter.
Well, I have the book before me now, and he pictures Lycidas. So Lycidas sunk low, but mounted high, through the dear might of him that walks the waves. Now he pictures him along other groves and other streams along, where he hears the unexpressive nuptial song and the blessed kingdoms meek of joy and love. And there entertain him all the saints above and solemn troops and sweet societies that sing. And what those saints above and their solemn little independent troops, you see, and presbyteries sing in solemn troops and sweet societies. They sing those marvelous Reformation hymns of joy and love. So to Milton, you see, the hereafter is a little independent Presbyterian meeting house.
It could be. You see, my picture of the hereafter. Just be faced by a nice little document, you see, like the Divinity School address, and surrounded by some minds that are illuminated, and we'll all get together and work it out. That's a heavenly picnic. Earthly paradise. There's not much difference. Don't take seriously anything I say about this. What I'm trying to do is, I have a little bit more freedom in handling this material, you know. I've done it longer than you have. And in my freedom, it will open it up for you. I don't test you on whether you're right or wrong, mostly. You can have various views, just so you can get into it. Is it bell run?
And that's our delightful little discussion of the Divinity School address on the Monday of the fourth week, Monday the 21st of April, 1969. And this is Channel 2 Right, about 100. Channel 2 Right, about 100. Channel 2 Right, about 100. The Divinity School address, the Monday of the fourth week, Monday the 21st of April, 1969. This is about 100, Channel 2 Right. Now this is Channel 2 over, around 100. This is the last day, towards the end of the second term, the 14th of March, 69. That's for the large class, that winter or middle term, the 14th of March, 69. Now this is a review, but I call it here the mythology, of course. And this is one thing I'm not sure how to handle. It's built up, but it's all mechanical. It ought to be assumed. We'll see. And this is channel 2 right, about beginning around 200 for this last week, what I call a mythology or a review, a mythology of the course, and this is the middle term. This is the last week, 14th of March, 69.
There is a little structure, or you might say the course holds together in a kind of plot or fable. I can line that out for you. You know it already. You see, we start with the 18th century, the neoclassical period, and we end in the modern period. We have those two limits for contrast. Now, you see, Franklin, as I presented it to you, or worked with you on it as we worked it out, Franklin is the springboard, both for Thoreau and Emerson. You see the Poor Richard's attitude there towards prudence is a springboard for Thoreau. Thoreau can outdo him in prudence, but he goes in another direction. Now Emerson and Thoreau both, you see, in the terminology. They use Poor Richard's self-reliance, but it's a vastly different thing. Now, one of the points you see that's supposed to help you. That's supposed to sort of clarify what the Thoreau and the others do. They do what Franklin, you see, and Poor Richard do not do. You see, and Thoreau, that's taken over in prudence. Now, take the next two, you see, Thoreau and Emerson. The fits into the little scheme of the course, you see, in that Thoreau is concrete and Emerson presents the theory. Then if you read into the biography, you find, really, you see, that Thoreau kind of bases his whole life on one or two little statements in Emerson's essay, first essay, Nature. Now, I think the thing about Emerson is, you read him and you find, you see, that he cannot be assimilated. He has to be lived with, you see. No one can work with Emerson with his mind. There's no sequence in his idea. But you can live with it, and you can see it. Then in Hawthorne, you see, at least part of this book, Hester's part of it, you see Emerson more clearly as Hester embodies Emerson. Now, we took a little detour in Poe. Poe really doesn't fit too well. But to skip Poe for the moment, I think the chief thing would be Whitman. Now, Whitman, you see, his relationship to Emerson, he carries all those Emersonian points so far. And I'd take over, in a way, I'd take over, you see, one of the little parts of talking myself, where he represents himself as the caresser of life. He is the caresser of everything. He embraces everything. He embraces so much. And of course, in the you can see from his prose, Specimen Days, that it's not just a pose with him, or not a imaginary thing, but he does come in contact with all those things. You see, Emerson says it's the day of the commoner, common man, but there's not one common man in Emerson. And as the biographer says, Emerson simply didn't know common men. Now, Whitman, you see, had gone so far that he could write it in. Now, you see, in the last part, the governor starts out as Emersonian, and the country house place is Emersonian. But it turns into something else. And as I've tried to point, handle all the material, just sort of keep it in hand, and not just take one book, and then we'll say, well, if we finish that book, we'll take another one. Try to point it. You see the plight of the governors. Now that's all. The first time I ever had a feeling for governors, as I may have mentioned, was when a member of my family came down to read with me. She'd finished high school, and her family wanted to go to one of the good colleges, and she knew she didn't know anything. And she was just feverish about it. And one summer, I was teaching some of this material. And the only member of my family who ever took a course with me, she came down. She didn't register. She just sat in, did the reading. She came down and did the reading, and the one character that appealed her, she was just rapt by, was the governess. And I said to her, what do you want to waste your time with that governess for? That's just the sort of a case study. And for the first time, I could see that the governess was not a case study. And she said something. But she had never spoken to me. So what I have to say to you now, you see, is something I have learned from, well, principally, you see, from my little niece who came down here and read. Now, as I try to get hold of the material and punt it, you see what happens to Emerson, but it also happens to us. And Emerson, you see, talks about society. It sounds so abstract. Until a person realizes that society has him by the hair and slinging him around. And until he realizes that, none of this material means anything. Until it ceases to be fiction, and as Emerson, as Whitman says, when you touch these poems, you touch a man. When it's, you see, then you see yourself right now. Lord help us, Lord help us. I'd hate to be in your shoes. I'm bad enough as it is, but I'd hate to be in your shoes right now with this next week coming up. Yes, any little thing, you know, any little thing. Well, you think, I don't know what your view of that is. You feel like you're Hester, the governor. Hester never actually, she suffered. I'm through with that now. We've talked about it, and I'll pass that on to you. But I said to you what I thought, that seeing the governess and analyzing it, or what did I say, what was it we said the other day? Seeing, accepting the governess's own diagnosis. Come out here. Sit down right there. She's got the measles. She just came over and told me. I said, don't come over and tell me you've got the measles. Just send me word. the governess, you see, it's the governess's own diagnosis of herself. So that, in a way, the governess who relates it, the older governess, has almost returned now to the Emersonian character. She has that Emersonian. You see, I'm looking for a word. I think it's the self-possession that belongs in that world. tatters. So that you see, as you see, and just see the governor's diagnosis of the experience. That is the Freudian, the psychological approach. Where simply she's not up to all the pressures that are put on her. And she finds that this experience is a trap. Now, you're talking in class. I don't have that in any... The pressure, you see, the pressure on her is too great. And she recognizes that it's a trap. She says it. Until one realizes, you see, that society itself is just one huge trap. Where the individual is caught and all he can do is wiggle. All these things about the generation gap. That's not what the young have to fear. I think the governor states the key much better than I see it in the SDS, or at least in the contact I have with them. To me, he never says anything that holds water at all compared with the governor. She's right in the midst of it, you know. All those things she says, it's not she says that she's nervous, but it's the fear that she will be nervous. Well, I'm past that. I know when I'm nervous. And I come in here and I tell you when I'm nervous. I think you know those things. Now, there's one other little point, and then we'll move. The diagnosis, you see, leads to the cure, the remedy. If you know what's going to happen to you, maybe you can take some steps to forestall it. Maybe. The likelihood is there's not much likelihood, but it's a possibility. Now, one other, like we said yesterday, a feeling for Hester and Thoreau with, I don't know what to call it, with their stability. I don't know. It seems like theirs is a stable world. Now, I know that won't hold. It'll be unstable, too. And that feeling that the governess had when she first came to Bligh, and the liberality in which she was treated, she felt. Just a glimpse of that old world. Now, I would localize it. I'd say that's the Victorian world. That's the 19th century world. That's the contribution of the family, the cultivated, not the intellectual, the cultivated family, you see, of the 19th century. And I've come in contact with that in books through Irving and these other people. And when I was in the army, I was in India and Burma and China. That's where I came in contact with it. I didn't come in contact with it in the Western country, but I saw it over there. And when I saw it, I thought, how can they have these revolutions over here and want to get rid of this? But they did, and they did get rid of it. That's a revolutionary. You see, the revolutionaries have no feeling for that revolutionary spirit. And in 1776, we must have appeared sort of barbaric, see, to the British with those curious notions that we have. Let me run through. I'd rather you do it, but let me run through it. Take Emerson. Now, these are the little Emersonian poems. Now, you can set these down. I can't write. You can't read my writing. You see, I'd start off as he does in Self-Reliance. The key word is genius. Now, that's the individual. And he's talking about, you see, we go in circles in this, and no words will hold. He's talking about the genius, you see, of the individual. And pretty soon you realize that the individual can be a commoner, common man, not Shakespeare in character, you see. But he is transferring that lofty word to the commoner. Now later, you see, he in that paragraph, he says that light that crosses the inner eye. And later he uses, you see, for that, for the genius, he uses intuition, perception, illumination. But I would start out, I think, with the important thing for the genius is the first thoughts. Where we see that's where we see the genius of the individual, in the first thoughts. I don't know any better way than he does it. You see, the first thoughts, what are they? And the genius, what is that? He defines it in terms of society, conformity and consistency. And what he says is, you know, that we think in terms of society, that's all we know, what people tell us and what we think we see and don't. And somehow or other, by whatever method it is, our mind has to be freed from society so that we can actually see society before the individual exists. Now, you don't care, you see, whether the philosophers will examine this and say that Emerson's point holds water. That's not the proof of it. I think the proof of that is what illumination it gives you. It gives you a marvelous insight into what goes on now, you see, in the schools and all our institutions and the newspapers. They all tell us, you see, that we are individuals who live in society. Well, we feel a part of society. Well, I don't object to that, and I'm not discouraging that. But that's not the Emersonian sense. If we're going to live in society, we're not individuals anymore. Except in such a different sense. Now, I'm not trying to decide anything, you know. I'm just talking with you, just presenting it. Feeling of society, our feeling for society, I think is the source of a great many of our errors. I think that's the feeling we have that makes us say that Franklin, you see, in the autobiography is puffed up. Identification with society. Now, you see, you don't want to praise or blame anything like that. All you want to do is just see it, just perceive it. That's all. I think that's, I certainly wouldn't want to try to improve on what Emerson sees there. Then in the other piece, you see, he's talking about in nature. He says, in the American Scholar, he's talking about nature, but he's actually talking about science. And science, he thinks of there as classification. And the logical processes and the systematic processes of science, or any study, you see, are not what he's talking about. Now, you can apply that, you see, in very small instances. Don't you know, I had just been reading this, and then I told you this commentary. And I was out with these people, and the little boy, you know, they were trying to teach him the birds, and he'd say, "What's that?" And his daddy would say, "That's a sparrowhawk." And it just occurred to me, oh, that's just classification in its most wooden form. The little boy say, "What's that?" "That's all right, but you can say that's a sparrowhawk, and he's looking for a mouse." They see those little pellets out there, say, "This is, as the mouse goes through him, it's all wrapped up like this." That is, it's doing something. So that's it. Now you ready to move along? He see, now this is I learned a good bit about this last term in working with Faulkner. What he says about education of a scholar, it seems so simple. And I could ask you a question: what is his proposal for the education of a scholar? And you say he puts nature first, book second, and living third. I wouldn't ask a question like that because I don't want any such mechanical answer. It'd just be tedious all the way around and leave the wrong impression. What you want to say, now what is it about nature that he finds useful? Well, one thing you see, he finds the language of nature as useful. But we didn't go into that. Now, that's in a little essay called Nature. And we didn't go into that. And you see, I wouldn't ask you that. I don't think your contact to nature is close enough to justify it. So I've left that out. Books, though. You see, that's the illuminating part about that is that most of the books Emerson's not interested in. What's that? A story building.
Cut trees off the skyscraper. The books, you see, the books
are for the scholar's idle time. I don't find that useful at all. I don't ask these questions about this book again. I seem to be draw the wrong fire. See, the only book, you see, Thoreau wouldn't read books. He read those Indian books, but he just read a paragraph or two he liked and then quit. Now, one of my young friends came down, I told you about that, came down here one spring. He flunked out of Duke, you know. He flunked out of undergraduate courses, but he then joined the Army and took a graduate course up there and made an A in it. And that's when he acted down here, when he was out there with me, and we put in 20 acres of corn for silage. He wouldn't read Thoreau with me because he hadn't read those Gitas, you know. He said nobody reads Thoreau unless he's read those Indian Gitas. Well, I hadn't read them. And I still haven't read them. But I should. I don't mean that way. But you see, their attitude towards books, you see, was right selected. Oh, Lord, just to have books. You see, the university rubs our noses in books. Me too. See, I'm in the same fix. I just read so many books, you see, I've got no mind left. I'm just was at one time, when my eyesight was a little better, I just thought, you know, I could just consume it, just chew up a book, you see, every morning, and then take another one in the afternoon. Oh, I've done that for months at a time at the Library of Congress, one place or another. Thoreau never did that. See, his mind was better than ours, mine. That's right. He didn't do it. He say, well, I'll take this course, it won't hurt me. The hell it won't. What's the matter with you now? I'm thinking from the point of view of Thoreau now, you see. Yeah. Now, as Thoreau said, you know, he's not proposing people follow his advice or live as he lived and go to Walden and live. You see, that's one of the great misunderstandings. He goes to Walden and the light he gets there, he passes on. It's only the light, the illumination he gets there that he passes on, not the fact that we ought to go out there and live in Walden. I don't know what I'd do if I was in Walden. I'd go in and steal cookies, too. All of that, you see, defines the individual. It's one type of book and one function of books, and that's all that he's talking about. That's an Emersonian function of book. And that's what he proposes. That's all Emerson did. He proposed for his books to do just that. That's all they do, if they do it. And it may be the whole essay, lecture he writes, never does that. But you have to read him like Thoreau read books and just take out a passage or two that suits you. I don't know. Now, you see, you'd flunk everything if you did that, wouldn't you? You wouldn't flunk in here. I don't think. You never know. Now, I'm talking so much you don't know. I'm trying to look at all the various facets of the Emersonian viewpoint. Am I talking so much you can't get it? Huh? I know I am.
think, you know, he says all along, this is not essential. It's a sort of an application. He says about the commonplace, or the common man, or the common person. That's a sign of the time. I don't know. You see, what he does, he sees the genius of that person, too. Now, what he says about religion is not a different subject. He's only applying it. And he says what religion commonly does is lower the stocks of people, of men. It gives a mean view of men. It does. Oh, yeah. You know what? I've been to church all my life. I've been to Sunday school and all like that, and I still go. And you know what Thoreau wrote about the woodchopper? I've never heard any appreciation of man in any religious organization with that want. They talk about a man's soul and all like that, but I'm not interested in my soul much of the time. I don't see that. I'm non-religious. But I'm getting off the deep end now. You see when I flounder. But you help me out. You see the direction of it. And the same thing applies, you see, to the holy books. It applies to all the other books. The holy books are, by and large, most of them are ill-conceived and ill-carried out. You have to look through them and look for the light. You know, I learned, you know, you learn a little running around with preachers. I've never done that much because they wouldn't run around with me. But I remember we used to sit over there and talk, and what I heard him say, that's preachers themselves don't get salvation until most of them at all, and some of them late in life, and well, nearly you can find out when they did. And the classic examples of that of Luther. He was a monk, an erudite, you see, before he saw the light and put those theses on the door. And Wesley, you see, you're rubbing your head again. Now, Wesley had been over to America and preached and done all those things, and he had to go back and saw that little light there from reading Romans 10 or whatever it was, and that's what came to him. From then on, you see, he saw the light. But he was middle-aged, as I remember, at least old enough. Where we started. He's applying it to religion, just applying it to religion. You can do the same thing. Now, he applies it to property. Property, by and large, you see, is weighs down in an individual. He pull, like Thoreau pictures the farmer at Concord, he pulling that big two-story house and 100 acres of land down the road, just dragging him down. Property. Now, I'm not that allergic to property. I've had more than I needed from time to time. You know, the worst property are these old broken-down cars. They keep you worn thin, you know, just wondering whether they get there or not. That's the same thing. Travel. Now, what is it you want to bring up about Emerson? Buddy? Now, you know all I've said. Now, you can't use him. Is that it? Well, that comes with practice. You could use him. You try. That's what the exam's for. Now, on the exam, on that first part, I want you to bring yourself in, if you will. I don't know. If you will, I don't mean a confessional. I don't mean that at all. But I mean to see how it applies to you. Can't you see yourself in between in those two directions of Emerson, the governor? You don't. Can't you? Don't you? You lay out the points you see that would apply to Hester Prynne or Thoreau, and then look how the governor violates those things. and then see where you stand. I mean, just for your own.
That's largely. That's the part I don't know just how. That's what I had hoped to put into that the first part of it, half hour or so.
Just let you prepare that ahead of time. Just work that out ahead of time. You can have your notes if you want to. Now let me see. How would you state that? Yeah.
You'd be saying that how you were saying the principle of sight or
so. Yeah.
How we stand in
front. Yeah. Yeah. I think one of the finest, if I had a copy of it, I don't have my books. You know, I think the best thing is to take a passage. Where is that? Yes, let me read just a little passage from about Hester. It's one that we've used. Hester sought not to acquire anything beyond an absolute, beyond a subsistence. That subsistence and prudence, I think, underlies all of them. Does it? I wouldn't call that an Emersonian quality, but it's the plainest and most ascetic description for herself and a simple abundance for her child. Her own dress was of the coarsest materials and the most somber hue. How would you handle that? See, your dress is not somber, and you don't live on a subsistence basis. The child's attire, on the other hand, was distinguished as fanciful. Except for that small, we may speak further of it hereafter, except for that small expenditure in the decoration of it, Hester bestowed all her superfluous means in the charity on wretches less miserable than herself, and who not unfrequently insulted the hand that fed them. Now, this is a part of it I hadn't thought of. But you see, what I've been talking to is sort of abstract. Now, what I'd do, I'd get a passage. I'd pin it down. This is a good passage. Much of the time, which she might readily have applied to the better efforts of her art, she employed in making coarse garments for the poor. It is probable that there, would this be her perfect function? Yeah.
Do you want us to take Hester and compare ourselves, like how Hester was the Emersonian point of view, and compare ourselves how we either follow or do not follow Hester?
Oh, I don't want you to compare yourself. I just want you to sort of,
or
you know.
Or do you want us to just talk about what we think of the Emersonian outlook in our life?
I don't know how that works out. I would compare it. Except for that small expenditure, Hester bestowed all much of the time which she might readily have applied to better efforts of art she employed in making coarse garments for the poor. It is probable that there was an idea of penance in this mode of occupation. You see, Hawthorne says probably, as if he's not sure. Well, there may be a little penance in it. So you see, there ought to be, I don't know. I wouldn't go too close. You've got to be more selective than that. It is probable. And that she offered up a real sacrifice of enjoyment in devoting so many hours to such rude handiwork. She had in her nature a rich, voluptuous, oriental characteristic. Now, as far as I know, nobody has come to grips with that quality of Hester, and I somehow have associated that with an Emersonian viewpoint like the, or I seem to make the Emersonian individual large. Large in the sense that you see pursuit will bring the faculties to light, even the pursuit of bad objects, or at least unpractical objects. She had in her nature that a taste for gorgeously beautiful. Women derive a pleasure in comprehensive others from the delicate tall needle. To Hester Prynne, it might have been a mode of expressing the absolute passion of her life. Like all other joys, she rejected it. And the morbid meddling of, see, I'm skimming some of this, the morbid meddling of conscience. See, that doesn't mean anything to me, so I skip it. But that dignity that Hawthorne attributes to her. Now you see that dignity. I think you can work with that. That dignity. You see, he's not talking about the commonplace now. He's talking about the reverse of it. And I think this life that Emerson talks about, actually he's talking about the genius of a commoner.
But as he also says in there that we can learn from kings and princes, you know, the state of a common man. That the commoner, you see, can attain that seat of the prince of the old world, of royalty. Now, it could be, you see, that his, that Hawthorne, now, you see, I'm not trying to be logical in this. I'm trying to let my mind do its own work and not force it. I'm not aiming at any conclusion. I'm just sort of getting it in my system. Let it come to me. What you've got here is a terminology. Here, you see, your mind is sort of in balance between the commoner and the prince, or dignity and the common. And you see, Emerson does that. And now let me tell you, you know what I think? It just comes to me. I think Hester, now you see, Emerson's a better historian. Hawthorne's a better historian than I am. And you know what I think? I read this somewhere that his Puritans are second generation Puritans. They were born here. And there's a great difference, historically speaking, in the ones who came here from the old world. Now, Roger Williams was one of our great men. But he wasn't great here. He's great where he came from. He is contemporary of Milton. And over here, he continues to be that. And Hutchinson was a product of the old world. Now, Dimmesdale was too. He's not a first generation, a second generation over here. Now, what he may see, you see, he may see in Hester some of that old world dignity and see it in a good light. And I have read, it's been a long time since I read it. The great lady of the Renaissance, the great lady of the Renaissance, like Queen Elizabeth and a good many of the others, and you see them in the plays. The great lady of the Renaissance was like Portia in The Merchant of Venice, was like Portia. Now, Portia had a great wit, a great presence, and she still spoke the language of this world. Now, I can't care. It's been so long since I read Portia. It could be that Hester is akin to Portia, and that unconsciously, subconsciously or something, whatever the word is, Hawthorne has borrowed, has been influenced by that. He read Shakespeare. Everybody then did, not only read him, but saw him. Now, if that's true, that means we have gone beyond that article that talked about her dignity. Who was it, Van Dorn? Was that Van Dorn? I forget. We've gone past that and seen that because, you see, Emerson, like I said, Emerson, you see, was subject to that too. Well, now look, the passage that I can read a little better is this one on the much of the marble coldness of Hester's impression was to be attributed to the circumstance. Now this is the first one that I can come to grips with. Much of the marble coolness of Hester's impression was to be attributed to the circumstance that her life had turned in a great measure from passion and feeling to thought. And in the in education, I don't know, as I look at education, it seems to me that is what takes place. As they say, most of the thinking of Americans or people in general is always feeling. You see, it's their emotion, it's not their mind. They feel, not think. And that's what it goes towards. In a great measure, from passion and feeling to thought, standing alone in the world, alone and hopeless of retrieving her position, she cast away the fragments of a broken chain. The world's law is no world's law of her world. You know the rest of it. It was an age in which the human intellect, newly emancipated, had taken a more active and wider range than it had for many centuries. And I can come to grips with that. My view of it is very, very limited, so that I wouldn't want you to take on my limitations. Now, that's what I would do in the first part. But now, let me tell you, for the examination itself, I would try to make clear statements. I would try to make clear statements and then go on. And I'll restate them and repeat them and repeat them and repeat them. I see so much of that. I wouldn't write essays and sort of chew up a thought, hold forth on some general topic. You see, you can do that. But I would stay close to the information. I'd speak in terms of passages and stay as close as I could to information, just like I was trying to do there. In that part there. Not that I did it. That's what I'll do on the exam. Now, here's another possibility. Let me tell you, on the exam, what you can do. Let me make one or two little points here, and I'll come right back. Let me tell you, something like this. Send the information you want to. But first, on what Thoreau says about the building his house, his cabin. For information. Now, that's the high point, you see, in his discussion of economy. And then relate his ideas on economy to poor riches. But do it through that focus on that case. Would that help you any? It's simple. It's on one thing. I might say that for all your questions. And if I did that, you see, I could stay pretty well in this Emersonian framework. And the only saying is you'd be tied down. The only thing you do, start out with a case. Work out the case. I never did that. I'd like to try it. No, that takes a vast amount of time. That book thing. No, I would review. That's the way I would review. As a matter of fact, that's the way I would study. Now, that's where I'd read. You talk about the whole character. You've got it pretty well focused in terms of these little passages where you can get a hold of them. Not only for the examination, but for the just reading in general.
So many facets to these different books.
That's
that,
right.
You know, like, you might pick out, let's say, you know, some passages that, you know, clarify a few, but if you ask a different passage, you know, passage that you consider important, you know, like, you spent your whole life and you know these passages, whereas for us, you know, it's kind of hard to pull these passages, you know, out of, thin air. You know, we can remember vaguely.
It's better, though. You see, when you're talking about the common man, as he's treated in this all these books, you see the most illuminating ones are the ones in Thoreau, John Field, and the Canadian Woodchopper, and those others I brought into you from your journal.
Yeah, that'd be a topic that we'd all consider, but you know, this is all new material for us, and I know, you know, we can't go through it, you know, and come up with all the facts, you know.
It'd be partly your method. My method wouldn't be exactly like yours. Probably you wouldn't do that. Then I do. See, I can't read a book without a pencil. I have to mark little things, and that's what I come back to. You don't do that.
Oh, I think we all mark our books. I'm sure all of
us. That's all
do.
I'm talking about.
Some, you know, as much as you have. We've got what.
And that's the end of this discussion, review for the examination, the last week of the middle term, the spring term, I guess, winter term, I guess it is, 14th of March, 69. And this is Channel 2 Right, around 8:35. Now this is Channel 2 Right. And this is Wednesday, the 16th of March, 1969. This is the second Wednesday of the last week of the review week. This is a tape for Wednesday, the 16th of March, 1969, the second day of the review. I had 2 days in a row, Monday and Wednesday, and this is Wednesday of the last week of the winter term, 1969, with that large, beautiful class.
Isolated questions, I would like for it all to hang together. I could, you know, if you were scholars enough, just tell you to give you a little thesis and let you work it out the whole 2 hours. But I've tried that, and it's people take it as a joke, you see. They're not up to it intellectually, and they can't actually handle it, and it appears sort of comical to them. And I don't want to put anyone in the wrong light. That's the way I think. Actually, what we've worked into, you see, is that Emersonian world, actually. You know, what do they do with evil? You know, like in theology, you always have the problem of evil, bad thing. Evil, you know. You don't know whether it's real evil or theological evil. There's a difference.
No matter how it seems like people are getting away with something and unpunished, that because, like in Dimmesdale's case, when he suffers more than Hester, whose suffering is, you know, noted, and she suffers in the public view, but Dimmesdale, who suffers internally, suffers the worst. Like, his action himself will suffer within himself. And he relates it to the idea of God and the idea of this internal spirit that will bring about this suffering, that, in a sense, the person will be his own judge, jury, and
Well, the old Puritan or Protestant world, you see, Calvin and Calvin's world, the evil was a major part of it. In James, whether it's true or not, but I have a feeling that James preserves that same sense of evil and puts it in the fiction just like Hawthorne does. That sense of evil in James, introduced by the letter, as one of the writers who was here one time, I heard him lecture on James and this, and he said, evil is so much stronger when it's unspecified. If the boy, if had told just what he did in school, it wouldn't be strong. And I think even James says, don't you know, the most considerable presence in the thing is the presence of that feeling of evil, of being evil, being imminent all the time. Evil. How does Whitman stand on evil? You see, on that song of the open road, there's no evil there. Doesn't magnify it. I think that's the most Emersonian of all our things, what we read, the home road. You know, what does he call it? The Democratic Vistas? He wrote that after the war. We mentioned that. You know the occasion for that? You don't have your book with you. Let me read you a little passage from it, if I can. These states is cankered, crude, superstitious, rotten. The depravity of the business classes of our country is not less and has been supposed, but infinitely greater. Pretty much of a blast, isn't it? Now, he said so much of that, what he figures in the Democratic Vistas is, does that invalidate his view of the American poet? He seems to have known this all along, yes. And Whitman and Emerson, all of them, you see, tell you why they don't dwell on evil. Exactly Emersonian, all my small talk at any rate. One of my friends out there would make help me came out last summer to make me help me make hay. I've been feeding it all winter. We were out close to the road and the highway, the state, the county highway people passed. And like the governor's, I watched him. People didn't speak. The boy who writes editorial, he goes to the University of Swanee. He sent me a good number of his editorial. Subject of editorial, that's one of your maladjustments. Either people work on the road or you're right in the neighborhood. Now they're out in a little country road. Now they come along, they don't even say nah. They don't even say hello. You speak, they don't speak. Well, now, I don't think, is that the way you want it? Well, that's evil. It's maladjustment. You think country fellas working on a country road would speak with us? Well, you'd see their piece that you see. Whitman, of course, would be the most outspoken about it. You look at these, I would look at these two traditions. Now, you want to pick out something particular? All I know, I wrote on the board back when we were going there. Don't you remember? I called them the categories. One would be evil. One would be their attitude towards art. Just slips in that halt on himself is hardly. Well, how do you feel? Thoreau is Emersonian in that sense. He's no beginning, middle, and end. You see, it's not organized. Certainly not. That's difficult in reading him. You're too much of an artist. Artistic, the art gets in the way. It's not. Whitman certainly not. And Mark Twain, art doesn't get in the way. See, Mark Twain never wrote a book, actually. In Huckleberry Finn, what he does is just take a little trip down the river. It's travel. I don't think he ever write anything with a plot. The thing he wrote was Innocence Broad. Well, I mean, big thing. And that was a series of small things. Little sketches he wrote from day to day. You really, in the American tradition, if you equate that with the Emersonian tradition, you don't get much art. Mind and the mathematical mind is pretty dull and logical, I think. That's what he sees in the 18th century in the neoclassical mentality. And he clashes with that, you know, in his stories. So in that sense, he is Emersonian, in that sense. Well, I think you could say a good bit, even in Poe, you see, about the art, that he violates artistic principles in his stories in those long introductions. See, that's not fiction. Shoot.
I have a question.
Yeah. That sure. That's all right. Good either way. Upside down and backwards and forwards. Came in and did it the other, you see. I told you I would take some Emersonian viewpoint, like, say, his view of logic and classification, or evil, the ability for the public function. But I came in here and did the other thing. I wrestled with character, I was the governor. And whatever little hints in our discussion, I tried to use. Yeah, the Emersonian view, as it comes to clashes in with the Freudian, a psychological view, a modern view, that will keep you in a straight line.
This is the end of Channel 2, right? This is the end of Channel 2. Wednesday the 16th of March, 1969. Wednesday the 16th of March, 1969. This is the end of Channel 2, right? The end of Channel 2, right? The last week of that winter term. the review. Now, these are 2 days in a review, a row, Monday.